From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, soul singer Jerry Butler. He had his first hit, For Your Precious Love, with The Impressions in 1958. Then he started his solo career and had such hits as He Will Break Your Heart, Moon River, Make It Easy on Yourself, Hey Western Union Man, and Only the Strong Survive, which is also the title of his new memoir. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews two movies that opened today for the holiday weekend, 102 Dalmatians, starring Glenn Close, and Unbreakable, starring Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush campaign is asking the Supreme Court to get involved in the election controversy. Bush lawyers want the court to throw out a decision by the Florida Supreme Court to accept hand-counted ballots. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The Bush campaign is hoping the nation's highest court will trump the Florida Supreme Court. Bush attorney Ted Olson says the changing electoral standards in Florida have resulted in chaos. He wants the Supreme Court to step in
before further irreparable harm is done to the integrity of this election and to the rights of voters in Florida and everywhere else in the United States.
The suit says the changing procedures in Florida have essentially disenfranchised voters and violated their rights, and it charges that the Florida legislature is supposed to set electoral standards, not the Florida Supreme Court. The Bush campaign wants the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the use of any hand-counted ballots. Many legal observers expect the High Court will refuse to hear this petition. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In another setback for Vice President Al Gore, Miami-Dade County election officials decided today not to go ahead with a hand recount. The county canvassing board said it wouldn't be possible for the recount to be completed by the Sunday deadline set by Florida's Supreme Court. 654,000 votes were cast in Miami-Dade County. Also today, a judge in West Palm Beach has ruled that Palm Beach County election officials must count so-called dimpled Chad, that is, punch card ballots where the hole has been indented but not enough to push out the paper center. That means that counters will have to review about 2,000 ballots that were set aside pending the judge's decision. In northern Israel, a car bomb has killed at least 2 people and wounded 50. Prime Minister Ehud Barak says he holds the Palestinian Authority responsible. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
A car parked in the town of Hadera, north of Tel Aviv, exploded at evening rush hour just as a packed bus was driving by. Witnesses describe a horrific scene of mutilated bodies and pools of blood. It's the second such attack this week. The Palestinian Authority has denied involvement in either one. Still, the first attack was followed by punishing Israeli air raids on Palestinian security buildings, and some fear a repeat. Earlier Wednesday, Israeli soldiers shot dead 4 Palestinians at a checkpoint in the Gaza Strip. The circumstances are disputed. Israel says the men included a local militia leader who had been firing on Israeli positions. Palestinian officials say those killed were all civilians and unarmed. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 95 points, or 0.9%, to close at 10,399 in moderate trading. The NASDAQ lost 116 points. This is NPR News. Doctors in Washington say Dick Cheney is recovering well after suffering a slight heart attack. The Republican vice presidential nominee had surgery this morning to prop open a slightly clogged artery in his heart. Doctors inserted a plastic mesh tube called a stent into the artery to keep it open. They say Cheney's expected to return home in 48 hours and to make a full recovery. Cheney's had a history of heart problems, including 3 heart attacks and a successful heart bypass operation. A federal judge has approved a plan to distribute a $1.25 billion settlement between Swiss banks and Jewish Holocaust survivors. A settlement was reached 2 years ago, but the money has not yet been dispersed. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Today's ruling by U.S. District Judge Edward Corman came after a public hearing where some survivors complained that the settlement was too small and the distribution plan flawed. But attorneys for the plaintiffs told the judge the settlement was fair. The plan would set aside $800 million for those who deposited money in Swiss banks and never got it back. At last count, some 80,000 people have identified themselves as depositors or their heirs. The remaining $450,000 will go to refugees who were denied entrance or were expelled from Switzerland, as well as slave laborers who were forced to work for companies with Swiss accounts. Most claimants will get between $1,000 and $2,500. Holocaust families could be paid early next year if a few last problems, including a pending appeal, are settled. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
The leader of the Florida State House says the legislature should intervene in the state's election crisis. Republican Mike Fasano says leaders of the GOP-controlled legislature are considering calling a special session. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. He had his first hit in 1958, singing lead with The Impressions, a group that included his longtime friend Curtis Mayfield. The song was For Your Precious Love. Butler left the group the following year and embarked on a solo career, going on to have such hits as He Will Break Your Heart, Make It Easy on Yourself, I Stand Accused, What's the Use of Breaking Up, and Only the Strong Survive, which is the title of his new memoir. Butler was born in rural Mississippi in 1939. 3 years later, he moved with his family to Chicago, where he still lives. In fact, he's gone into local politics and is serving his fourth term on the Cook County Board of Commissioners. Let's start with some music.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy.
Oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, 'cause the woman that you love is gone. Oh, there's gonna be a whole lot of trouble in your life. So listen to me, get up off your knees, 'cause only the strong survive. That's what she said, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Yeah, you gotta be strong. You better hold on. Don't go.
Jerry Butler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Tell us the story behind this song.
Actually, this song and the lyrics were actual conversation that I had with my mother when I was about 16 years old. I was in love with an older woman, if you can believe that. And naturally, she said, this is a kid. I've got to move on with my life and do some other things. And so she just kind of dropped me like a hot potato. So I went, told Mama, hey, look, this is the end of the world. She said, boy, let me tell you this. That you have not seen half of the beautiful, lovely women in this world, and for you to be going through these kinds of changes this early in your life is absolutely ridiculous. Get out of here, you'll get over it, and only the strong survive was really created out of that conversation. Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff were the co-writers on it, but the introduction that was recited was really from that conversation with my mother.
How long was the gap between that conversation with your mother and writing the song?
Oh, years, as a matter of fact. The song wasn't written until 1967. That conversation with my mother is circa 1956, or somewhere in there.
What made you think so long after the fact of using that conversation as the basis of a song?
You know, I really don't know. We were sitting in a studio in New York City, the old Mercury Recording Studios, in the Carnegie Hall building. And Leon started playing this dot-dot-dee-dot on the piano. And I said, I remember my first love affair. And it just flowed from that point.
What would you say is the importance of this song in your career?
You know, first of all, it was the first legitimate gold record. And when I say legitimate gold record, I mean For Your Precious Love and He Will Break Your Heart probably were gold records, but I never received one for it.
Right.
Only the Strong Survive was the first record that I actually got from a recording company that said, you are certified as having sold over 1 million copies of this song. So from a standpoint of my career, it was a very important song. But more important than that was that it was during the period of the Civil Rights Movement. It was near the end of a lot of things were happening. The Black Power Movement was in vogue. And as a matter of fact, I realized that the song was a hit doing a concert at Prairie View College in Prairie View, Texas. And the kids had kind of adopted the slogan, Only the Strong Survive, as their theme song. Some months later, I was down in North Carolina, and a little lady, white lady down there, said to me, you know, Jerry, I've been trying to teach my children and grandchildren this theme all of their lives, and your song has helped me to make it real. And then there were a bunch of soldiers who came back from Vietnam who told me that Only the Strong Survive was helpful in seeing them through some very trying times, and they believed that it had helped them to come out of those foxholes.
What was your mother's reaction to having her advice immortalized in your song?
You know, my mother, very spiritual lady, and she always said to me, you know, you are really trying to preach through your music. And so she just kind of accepted it as part of what I was intended to do. She's up until the time that she died, believed that I should be a minister rather than a singer.
Not something you believed, apparently.
No.
My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. He has a new autobiography called Only the Strong Survive. Now, you first sang gospel music. You were part of a group called the Northern Jubilee Singers, and Curtis Mayfield was in that group, too. And, of course, you also sang together in The Impressions. How did you first meet?
Curtis's grandmother, the Reverend Annabelle Mayfield, was the pastor of this little congregation called the Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church. And Curtis's older cousins had this little group called the Northern Jubilee Singers. I wound up at this church one afternoon with a friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Terry Williams, because we just had singing in common and loved to do it. And he said, I want you to meet these people and get to know them, and maybe you'll decide to get involved with the group. In fact, I did. We used to kick Curtis to the side because he was probably 9 years old. He was the little guy. You know, I was 13. I was an old man. And so we kind of kept shoving him to the back, until he learned how to play the guitar. And then he kind of just took over because he was the real musician out of the group.
Had your voice changed yet?
As a matter of fact, it had. My voice went into the baritone register when I was about 13, and it has never come up again.
What about Curtis Mayfield's? His couldn't have. He was only 9. How did he sound?
Well, you know, Curtis was just the opposite. Curtis always kind of sounded like a little girl, you know. You gotta keep on pushing. Can't stop now. Move up a little higher. So he always had that kind of thing going. And I think over time, he effectively, as Smokey has done, used it to the point that it became really kind of his natural sound.
Now, did you and Curtis Mayfield leave gospel music for rhythm and blues at about the same time?
You know, see, we were never big and famous as was Sam Cooke or Lou Rawls with the Pilgrim Travelers and Sam Cooke with the Soul Stirrers. We were basically a local group of kids attached to this one particular church. And even though on occasion we might wind up in the company of those great stars, we were never really known outside of the city of Chicago. And so when we started singing rhythm and blues, nobody was really affected by it, but maybe the people who belonged to the church and us. When Sam left, that was an uproar throughout the whole country in most of the churches, because here was this gospel icon that had gone from singing the sacred music to singing the secular music. And so there was a lot of, gnashing of teeth and carrying on about that. But Curtis and I, we really made the, and I would like to say we made an extension rather than a transition. because even in Curtis's music, throughout the civil rights movement or what have you, you can still hear the strains of the gospel. And he really wrote kind of inspirational songs as opposed to what I call Hope to Die love songs, which are the kind of things that I was writing.
What's an example of a Hope to Die love song?
Your precious love means more to me than any love could ever be. Whereas he was writing, gotta keep on pushing, can't stop now, move up a little higher, you see?
Yeah, yeah.
A difference in attitude.
Well, I think it's time to hear your first hit. For Your Precious Love, which was recorded in 1958 when you were with the Impressions. And you say that this was that the lyric was originally a poem that you wrote when you were in high school?
Yes, a poem called They Say, as a matter of fact, as you will hear it in the lyric.
Was it changed at all for the lyric, or is it exactly the same?
The only thing that was changed is the title, For Your Precious Love.
Okay, this is 1958, Jerry Butler and the Impressions. My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. That's his 1958 hit with the Impressions, For Your Precious Love. And he has a new memoir called Only the Strong Survive. Now, let's talk about how you recorded that song. You had been with a group that was, I think, called The Roosters?
Actually, The Roosters became The Impressions.
Right. So who changed the name to The Impressions?
It was Curtis's idea. Now, Curtis said one day after we had decided that, well, let me give you a little history.
Yeah.
The Roosters was Arthur and Richard Brooks and Samuel Gooden, who were from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And while they were living there, they had a group called Four Roosters and a Chick, which is very cool for Chattanooga, Tennessee. They came to Chicago hoping that they were going to get a recording contract because at that time, Chicago was one of the music centers of the United States. Lots of record companies here. The Chick and one of the Roosters decided that these other three Roosters had lost their marbles and they weren't coming to Chicago on this fool's errand. Curtis and Jerry Butler then become the other two Roosters. And then one day we were doing something at my wife's home, as a matter of fact, down in the basement. And one of the little smart aleck friends of hers said, "Cock-a-doodle-doo!" And that kind of wiped out the Rooster name. We said, "No, man, we've got to change this name." And Curtis said, "Well, wherever we go, what we want to do is to leave a lasting impression." And we said, "That's it. That's what we're going to call ourselves, The Impressions." And that's how it came about.
My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. His new memoir has the same title as his 1968 hit, Only the Strong Survive. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Did you belong to someone? Did you belong to someone? I need to belong to someone. It hurts to be known as no one.
My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. He has a new memoir called Only the Strong Survive. Now, you recorded For Your Precious Love in your first recording session for VJ, and you also recorded that day Sweet Was the Wine, which was supposed to be the A-side.
Actually, we thought, when I say we, I thought, and most of the people who were in the room when For Your Precious Love was recorded felt that For Your Precious Love was a hit. But because it was such a ballad and so slow and so spiritual in feeling, the record company wanted to go with the other side, which was more up-tempo and danceable and supposedly more what teenagers were all about. But For Your Precious Love won out, and it was just one of those songs that teenagers as well as older people enjoyed, and it became the A-side.
Were there any squabbles about who would get to sing lead on your first recordings?
You know, it kind of came with the song. For instance, if Curtis wrote the song, Curtis sang the lead. If I wrote the song, I sang the lead. There was a squabble after For Your Precious Love was released because Vivian Carter, who owned VJ Records and was the V in VJ Records, I should say, was also a disc jockey in Gary, Indiana, and she decided, having had an experience with a group called the Spaniels, where she wanted to take the lead singer and give him a career of his own, but he was so interwoven with the fabric of the Spaniels that she was afraid she would destroy the whole thing, made a promise to herself that the next time someone came through that door that had a unique sound and had a unique voice in it, that she was going to build that unique voice along with the group, so that in later years, if there was a breakup or if she decided to move one of the parts toward another career, she could take one act and make two. The Impressions happened to be that act, and Jerry Butler happened to be that voice. And so when the recording was released, it was released as Jerry Butler and the Impressions, and the group never recovered from it. We argued and fought about the billing from that day until the day I left, which was about 7 months, 8 months later.
Did that have to do with your leaving?
Yes.
Explain more about that.
Well, here we were, five young guys, walked into a recording studio as the Impressions, walked out as Jerry Butler and the Impressions. The other four guys were wondering, well, what did Jerry do to get top billing? How did all of a sudden it start to look as though we're working for him as opposed to him being just part of the group? When we got to the Apollo Theater in New York, they have Jerry Butler in great big letters, the Impressions in small letters. By the time we get to Miami, Florida, there's just Jerry Butler on the marquee, no Impressions at all. And in each one of those places, the other guys refused to perform because their feelings were hurt, their pride was hurt. They just never could understand it. And no matter how much I told them that I hadn't done anything, that this was a decision that had been made by the record company, they just never bought it.
Did you realize yourself at the time how talented a singer and songwriter Curtis Mayfield was?
No. You know, Curtis was, when we first started, writing fairy tales, you know, Minstrel and Queen, Gypsy Woman, those kinds of little songs. And they were cute, but they, to me, did not show any out-of-sight kind of talent. About 1963, two or three, somewhere in there, he started to write the songs that, to me, were really Curtis Mayfield. He had matured to the point where he was writing We're Winner, Keep On Pushing, Say It's All Right, I'm So Proud of You. And then in the late 60s, he starts to do movie scores. Superfly, mm-hmm. And Let's Do It Again, and Claudine. And that was when, you know, my head started spinning around and I said, you know, this guy who I've treated as a younger brother most of his life and as a kid brother that is really a genius.
You wanted him to work as your backup guitarist when you went solo.
Yeah, actually, what happened was, when the group broke up, I got my share of whatever was left and started out on a solo career. I was performing in Washington, D.C. And my guitarist, who denies to this day that he did it, a fine guitarist by the name of Philip Upchurch, just quit. And he said, I'm leaving. I got a better gig, and I'm out of here. I was in a lurch. I didn't know what to do. I needed a musician to help me get through these performances. And so I called on my friend Curtis, and he responded. He said, you know, all I can play are the songs that I've written or the songs that we wrote together, and yeah, I'll do that. And so he flew out to Washington, and we started to work together. And out of that, we developed some songwriting skills between the two of us, and we started a publishing company called Kurtom Music, which he later sold to Warner Brothers Music for a whole lot of money.
If you're just joining us, my guest is soul singer Jerry Butler, and he has a new memoir called Only the Strong Survive. Now, you say in your memoir that when you were a, quote, lightweight celebrity, before you became very famous, that you still lived in the housing projects in Cabrini Green in Chicago.
Yes.
And you say you used to be able to ignore the pee in the elevators and the stairs, the wine bottles and junkies. You'd been surrounded by that kind of filth most of your life. But then it became too much to bear. What changed that made that filth too much to bear?
You know, you become oftentimes a product of your environment. Once you have something else to compare it to, then it's difficult. You know, it's like, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry?
Mm-hmm.
You know, suddenly we were moving around. We were being treated as celebrities. We were eating in restaurants. We were going and living in hotels where the rooms were spick and span and the beds were made up perfectly, and there was no smell of urine around. And suddenly we realized that it was within our reach to get out, to be part of a bigger and better world. And what I am hoping that the book will do, and as I go around talking to a lot of young people who are still living in those kinds of conditions, that you can get out. You have to work. You have to compete, but you can get out.
Jerry Butler will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called Only the Strong Survive. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Find yourself another girl who will love you, choo, choo, choo. Find yourself another girl. Save her love and kisses just for you. Save her love and kisses just for you. Well, the very first time I fell in love.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm telling you all. I'm telling you. Coming up, Jerry Butler tells us how he got the nickname Iceman. Also, Henry Sheehan reviews two movies that opened today, Unbreakable, starring Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, and 102 Dalmatians, starring Glenn Close.
But before the day is gone, I find out I've done something wrong. I'm a telling you all. I'm a telling you. I'm a-telling you, oh, I'm a-telling you. Days are getting longer and my nights are getting shorter and my way gets darker and my work gets harder now. When I get home, the wife is mad. The little girl, she's feeling bad. Little Junior, he's got the blues. Says he needs a pair of baseball shoes. I'm a telling you, oh, I'm a telling you. I'm a telling you, yeah. I'm a telling you.
Days are getting longer and mine. Nights are getting shorter and mine. Way gets darker and mine. Work gets harder now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with soul singer Jerry Butler. He had his first hit, For Your Precious Love, in 1958 when he was singing with the Impressions. His solo hits include He Will Break Your Heart, Make It Easy on Yourself, I Stand Accused, and Only the Strong Survive, which is also the title of his new memoir. Were you self-conscious when you first started entering the world of celebrity? Self-conscious because you'd come from the housing projects. You weren't used to being around, you know, fancy restaurants with swell clothes and all that stuff.
Well, my wife and mother tell me that I am basically a shy person. But certainly when you are in an environment that's foreign, that you're not accustomed to, there's always a bit of nervousness attached to that. You wonder how you're being perceived by the company that you're in, how they're going to react to the statements that you make, how they're going to react to the things that you do. And then because it's show business, and because in those days, the young people who were fortunate enough to become successful became the heroes not only of the youth of the community, but of the older people too, because they saw in us things that they had been denied, opportunities that they did not have. And so it was important. And we talk about it sometimes, how Frankie Avalon and Fabian could work in khaki pants and buck shoes and sweaters, whereas the black performers usually wore suits and tuxedos and dressed
to
the nines.
Yeah, that's right.
And folks say, well, why are they so dressed up? Because we represented a whole people. It wasn't just us. We represented opportunity. We needed to look and to act and to behave. And it's one of the reasons why the Motown School was crafted and invented, so that Diana Ross and the Supremes came to the stage looking well-coiffed and well-mannered and well-spoken.
What did you like to wear for your shows?
I still wear tuxedos.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, even if I'm working outdoors. Well, because I kind of like the look.
Let's hear what I think was the first hit you had when you went solo, He Will Break Your Heart?
Yes.
Yeah.
With Curtis singing in the background. So even though it's a solo record, it's not really. It's more of a duet.
And how did this become the song that you made?
What happened was my wife, Annette, Curtis, and a young fellow by the name of Eddie Thomas, who was at that time working as a roadie, we were driving from Philadelphia to Atlantic City, and we were talking about how the girls would hang at the backstage door to get a chance to say hello to the stars, and hopefully they would get a chance to be invited out, and et cetera, et cetera. And then the next morning, the artists would leave town, and those same girls would go back to whoever they were dating, whatever they were doing before the star came to town, and that was the concept behind He Will Break Your Heart. He uses all the great quotations. He says the things I wish I could say, but when he takes his bow and makes his exit, you know, I'll be there to take you home. Because I'm Jerry. I'm Jerry, always be here. That guy is Jerry, gonna be gone in the morning.
Okay, recorded in 1960, this is Jerry Butler with Curtis Mayfield, He Will Break Your Heart.
Farewell, I know you're leaving.
That's Jerry Butler, recorded in 1960. He has a new memoir called Only the Strong Survive. Let me get to another hit you had, Moon River, which is the Henry Mancini song, the title song from the movie of the same name. This is a much more, I mean, Andy Williams also had a hit of this, and his hit was a very, like, middle-of-the-road kind of recording. Did you consider this a different direction for you musically?
Well, if allow me to make one small correction in your statement, first of all.
Yeah.
The movie was entitled Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Of course, right,
and
yes.
And not Moon River.
Yes.
But the song was sang in the movie by Audrey Hepburn, sitting on a windowsill with an acoustical guitar. Henry Mancini and Johnny Mercer were the writer, and they wanted to get as many people to record this song as possible because they were sure that it was going to at least be nominated, if not win, the Academy Award. Nobody wanted to record the song. First of all, it was a waltz. Second of all, it was Moon River. Well, where is Moon River, and what is that all about? Calvin Carter, who was the brother of Vivian Carter, who owned VJ Records and was the A&R man for the company, said, "Jerry, this is going to be an important song for your career. Sing this song." Curtis and I took the song, and we hated it in three-quarter time, so we put it in 4/4 time. Well, when we got to the studio singing it in four, it was about 4 minutes, 15 seconds long, which was far too long for airplay in that period of time. And so we had to speed it up. In speeding up the tempo, we got into a slight cha-cha, bossa nova kind of rhythm. And that gave it a different edge. So we added a guitar to give it that country western flavor and a harmonica. And then we just draped all these violins and strings around it to give it New York sophistication. Because that's really what the whole deal was about, was that there was this pretty young girl who was from some rural area who had come to the big city, and she was dealing with this concept of a Moon River wider than a mile. She was going to cross it in style. She was going to be somebody. She was going to do all these wonderful things. And so we had the first vocal recording of Moon River. Mancini and Mercer believed that I should have sang it on the Academy Awards show. The problem was that CBS, which was the company that Columbia Records was owned by, was also planning to give Andy Williams a television show. And they needed a theme song for his show. And he had recorded this Breakfast at Tiffany's album, and Moon River was going to be that song. Moon River got the Academy Award. Andy Williams sang it, and it became the theme song for his show.
You feel kind of cheated by that?
You know, I think when it first happened, I did. But if I had sang Moon River on the Academy Awards show, my life probably would have been a lot different than the life I've had, which has been pretty good.
Okay. Let's hear 1961 Jerry Butler's recording of Moon River. Jerry Butler, recorded in 1961. Let's get to another recording. This was from 1962, and this is your recording of the Burt Bacharach, Hal David song, Make It Easy on Yourself. How did you get to work with Bacharach?
You know, Burt had recorded Make It Easy on Yourself as a, I guess, a demonstration record with Dionne Warwick, who was really his voice. And they took this record to Scepter Records. Florence Greenberg at that time was the president, owner of the company. she fell in love with Dion's voice, but she didn't like Make It Easy on Yourself. And so Bert was kind of stuck with this big production on this song and no place to go with it. He used it as a demonstration record and sent it to Calvin Carter out here in Chicago. And Calvin said, "Jerry, this is a good song. We ought to record this song." And I said, "Okay, who are we going to get to arrange it?" He said, "I like the way this guy arranged the song. And so we're going to use him." And we went back to New York and we hired Bert to do the arrangement. And that's how Make It Easy on Yourself came about.
My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. His new memoir has the same title as his 1968 hit, Only the Strong Survive. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is soul singer Jerry Butler. He has a new memoir called Only the Strong Survive. When we left off, we were talking about working with Burt Bacharach on recording the Bacharach song, Make It Easy on Yourself. Did you learn anything musically from working with Bacharach, or learn anything about singing this particular song? Did he give you any advice about this particular song?
You know, Burt and I were kind of at odds. Bert was a very strict musician in the sense that, and especially with his songs, because most of these songs were new, had never been heard before, and he wanted to make sure that the melody was precise and that the rhythm was precise. That's why I said he used Dion the way he used her, because Dion was like an instrument for Bert. Do you know the way to San Jose? Dot, da, da, da. Dot, dot. You know, very structured. She could have been a trumpet.
I know exactly what you mean.
Okay. I had a tendency to lay back. Oh, breaking up is so very hard to do. Ba-ya-do-dee-da-da. Because I wanted people to hear my phrasing. Bert wanted people to hear his song. And so we argued a lot about, well, you came in late. And I said, but that's where I felt it. That just doesn't fit the
book. So you kind of won on that one, don't you think?
Well, you know, I kind of had a lot going in my favor. I was, quote, unquote, the star. He was a fledgling arranger, just getting started. And the record company was paying the bill. And so, which meant eventually I was going to pay the bill because they were going to charge all of this stuff back to me.
Right.
But we did, in fact, work as well as we could together and became good friends. But I never had another hit with any of his songs, whereas Dion had several.
Do you feel like you did what you wanted to do with Make It Easy on Yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, after I recorded it, it became what was known in the industry as a turntable hit. Got lots of airplay. And we sold maybe a quarter million, half million records or so. Later, a group from England called the Walker Brothers re-recorded it pretty much the same way that I had done it. And then, to show how what goes around comes around, in the early 70s, Dion re-records a song that I had learned from her demonstration record and had a big hit with it herself.
Well, let's hear your 1962 version of Make It Easy on Yourself.
Just tell me that we're through. and make it easy on yourself. Make it easy on yourself. Cause breaking up is so very hard to do.
That's Jerry Butler, and he has a new memoir called Only the Strong Survive. I'm going to skip ahead and get to the present because you're also in politics now. You're serving your fourth term, I think it is, on the Cook County Board of Commissioners, and that's basically what, like city council?
Yes, I guess you could call it. Let's say that it is the legislative body for the county of Cook, which is the second largest county in the United States, and Chicago happens to be the county seat.
Why are you in politics?
Well, everything is political. I was listening to one of your shows earlier, and you were talking to the young man about the whole political structure of Gore and Bush and what have you. Whatever this country does is going to affect everybody that's in it, the high, the low, the rich, the poor, the entertainer, the non-entertainer, the athlete, or the guy that can't throw a ball across the street. Everybody will be affected by the decisions that these people make. As a performer for some 40-some years, I have had the opportunity to help elect people to office, to attract people to forums where some person can expound their ideologies and philosophies and what they would do if they were elected. And so in 1985, when Harold Washington was the mayor of the city of Chicago, he was looking for some candidates for the Cook County Board of Commissioners to run against the Democratic machine's slate. And myself, Charles Bernardini, a former school teacher by the name of Bobby Steele, became the Harold Washington candidates for seats on the Cook County Board. All three of us won. Two of us, Bobby Steele and myself, are still there. Charles Bernardini later went on to become an alderman, and so it worked out very well. But the concept of, first of all, I thought it would be novel that a rhythm and blues singer would wind up running for political office. But more importantly, we wanted to build a new Cook County Hospital. That new Cook County Hospital will now open 2002. And so we have done a lot of the things that we said we were going to try and do.
Are you still performing?
I am.
Good.
Love to do it.
It's been so much fun to talk with you. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jerry Butler's new memoir is called Only the Strong Survive.
Not a crime, 'cause I'm guilty.
Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews two movies that opened today, Unbreakable and 102 Dalmatians. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
Thanksgiving is the beginning of the holiday film season. Henry Sheehan has a review of two movies that open today for the Thanksgiving weekend. Unbreakable is the follow-up to M. Night Shyamalan's hit The Sixth Sense. 102 Dalmatians is the sequel to 101 Dalmatians.
The holiday season is now officially upon us, summoning up those images of bygone childhood. I remember being dragged through tacky, third-rate department store displays by my stressed-out parents who, half-threatening and half-pleading, kept insisting that I was having a great time. Now I'm grown up, but I'm still being coerced into accepting cheap glitter for honest tinsel. A cinematic example is Disney's 102 Dalmatians, a sequel to the live-action 101 Dalmatians of a few years back. 101 was formulaic filmmaking, but at least it got the formula correct. Lots and lots of charming dogs performing canine shtick, while a few humans try to mess with them. 102 is lots and lots of Glenn Close shtick, with only a little dog accompaniment. Close once again plays Cruella de Vil, the monstrous society matron who wants to kill and cut up some cute puppies for the sake of a coat. Close hams it up unashamedly. Still, it was what she was hired for, and the 101 filmmakers made sure she didn't take over the movie. The makers of 102 appear to cower in Close's presence. Certainly the audience will. Her shrill, shouting, overscale performance is in keeping with the hectoring nature not just of 102 Dalmatians, but so much so-called family entertainment. M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable, the other major Thanksgiving release, certainly can't be accused of copying from anything. Bruce Willis stars as a Philadelphia security guard who miraculously becomes the lone survivor of a catastrophic train wreck. But the film's title isn't just descriptive, it's ironic. While his body may be unscratched, Willis's psyche is nearly shattered. In a weakened emotional state, he becomes susceptible to influence from a strange, comic book-obsessed art dealer played by Samuel L. Jackson. All this may actually disappoint people who crowd the theaters this weekend looking for another audience pleaser from the writer-director of The Sixth Sense. That was terrific entertainment. But now, after his fourth movie, it's clear Shyamalan doesn't think of himself primarily as an entertainer. Unbreakable is now the writer-director's third film to deal with the psychological effects of metaphysical experiences and is most ambitious yet. He goes out on a limb thematically by suggesting comic books contain ancient occult knowledge. He goes out on an even thinner branch stylistically. He trowels on the atmosphere so thick that he nearly entombs the movie. Listen to this scene between Willis and his wife, played by Robin Wright Penn, as the security guard searches his memory for clues to his possible invincibility.
I wanted to ask you a question. It's going to sound a little strange, but just think about it for a second, okay?
Okay.
When's the last time I was sick? Do you remember?
I don't know. It's been a while.
I haven't been sick this year, I know that.
Okay.
Do you remember me getting sick?
Not a specific day. What's this about?
Audrey, do you remember me ever getting sick? In the 3 years we lived in this house? In the old apartment? Before Joseph was born, before we ever got married.
I can't remember.
Don't you think that's kind of weird? Not remembering one cold, or a fever, or a sore throat. What do you think it means?
When a filmmaker makes a movie about an ordinary schlub who suspects he's a superhero, you can imagine how he might want to avoid even the slightest hint of facetiousness. But instructing your actors to declaim as if they were part of a nightclub hypnotist act isn't the solution. What's frustrating is that this is only a superficial problem. The movie has an effective climax and an interestingly drawn-out denouement. The comic book stuff is sometimes silly, but the perception of human longing for gods and heroes isn't. The movie never overcomes its limitations, but it never gives up on its strengths either. If you want to get in touch with your inner adult this weekend, there's a movie out there to guide you. Curtis Hanson's Wonder Boys, based on Michael Chambon's novel, failed to find an audience when it was released last spring. Now it's back in the hunt. Michael Douglas stars as a novelist and English professor who finds his personal and professional lives imploding during a weekend academic festival. Frances McDormand is his adulterous lover who has taken just about all she can. Toby Maguire is the undergraduate whose own fiction seems ready to eclipse his teacher's. And Robert Downey Jr. is the flamboyant literary agent who shows up to perform publishing triage. It's witty, it's sophisticated, it's worldly, it's worth giving thanks for.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Change Before the Change, Everything You Need to Know to Stay Healthy in the Decade Before Menopause, by Dr. Laura E. Corio and Linda G. Kahn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a tribute to Hoagy Carmichael, the composer of Stardust, Skylark, Heart and Soul, and Georgia on My Mind. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.